Hi everyone, welcome to this week's episode of No Such Thing as a Fish. Before you fast forward, we have news of some live shows coming up, which you can go to live in London or you can stream. But first of all, let me tell you about today's show, which we recorded live at the Royal Institution in London. It is one of the most venerable places in the entire United Kingdom. It's where multiple elements were discovered. It's where some of the great scientists in history have spoken. And then they let us four dorks turn up. Really hope you enjoy this show. It was the first of four that we did. They will go out over the next 4 weeks. There were brilliant audiences every night. I'm sure you will enjoy listening to them as much as we enjoyed recording them. And if you would like to come to a live recording, then guess what? We are doing a couple more in September. On Saturday, the 12th of September, we are returning to the London Podcast Festival at King's Place, which is near to King's Cross Station in North London. And at 7 p.m, we'll be doing a live recording of the main episode. There are not many tickets left for that, so if you want to come to that, then get in there quick. But even more excitingly, I think, is that at 4:30 p.m, we will be doing our first ever live Drop Us a Line. It is our audience feedback show. It is normally only available for people who are members of Patreon, but you could be there. If you want to ask your question or send us an extremely pedantic email, you could be there in person. If you bought tickets to the show already, or if you buy tickets, then email podcast@qi.com and let us know that you're going to be there. Let us know what your question is, or your piece of pedantry. Let us know your bonus bream. Let us know your thanks but no thanks, and we might well read them out. Both of these King's Place shows will be live streamed and available on Catch Up, and you can get a discount if you buy tickets to both shows, either in-house or on live stream. So go to nosuchthingsafish.com/live to get tickets for that. And in the meantime, please enjoy this week's episode of No Such Thing as a Fish, recorded live at the Royal Institution. Okay, on with the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of No Such Thing as a Fish, a weekly podcast, this week coming to you live from the Royal Institution in London. My name is Dan Schreiber. I am sitting here with Anna Tyshinsky, Andrew Hunter-Murray, and James Harkin. And once again, we have gathered around the microphones with our four favorite facts from the last 7 days, and in no particular order, here we go. Starting with fact number one, and that is Anna.
My fact this week is that the building we are in contains the former world's largest pencil.
There's a photo of it behind us, and that's a big pencil.
Yeah, but we're burying the lead here, because that is an even bigger ruler than the world's largest pencil.
No, Andy, we're burying the lead.
There we go.
There you are.
Oh, come on. There's going to be another 59 minutes of this, guys.
Yes, that is, in fact, in this photo, carrying that pencil is the man who made it famous. Famous being a stretch. But... this was in 1968 that it had its debut, and it, as you probably know, this room is famous for very excellent, interesting lectures before we got here, and someone who gave a lecture was a physicist called Philip Morrison in 1968, and he opened his lecture with a huge penny on the floor, and he said, okay, who's going to come up and measure this penny? And he pulled out this huge ruler, which people in the room can see, a 12-foot-long ruler to measure it with. And then he said, okay, and let's write down how big this penny is. And for no particular reason, he produced an enormous pencil
right.
to write that
down. I think there was some reason
there was
behind
reason.
It, right? Because he was like doing a lecture about things that are very, very big or very, very small. So he's imagining what it would be like if he was a Lilliputian.
So Gulliver's Travels. Yeah,
that's true. They were called the Gulliver's Lectures. Yeah, it did feel like you've made your point with the ruler, and now you could just do it with a normal pencil. But he went to the trouble, and that's what we love.
Wonderful.
And yeah, it was about how crucial size is in science. So things act really differently if they're really, really, really big, like, you know, universe scale compared to really, really, really tiny. And he got some little children to come up from the audience to operate it. And it was a great lecture. I watched it. It was excellent. I really like how things were different back in the day, as I say, audience of 10, 11-year-olds. One quote from it is, Of course, you know very well that the theories of Euclid simply do not apply in the non-Euclidean geometry of a sphere.
Right.
The 10-year-old's nodding along.
I think they cover that in K-pop Demon Hunters.
So how big... Oh, okay, Scott, how big is this pencil?
It's hard to picture, isn't it? So it's like, so the ruler was 12 foot, so I guess the pencil's about 9 or 10 feet. It's hard to imagine. Do we
how
have anything...
How big are these desks?
Yeah, this must be 4 or 5.
Do we have anything in the building that's roughly the size, do we think, of the pencil?
For listeners at home, Dan has just come in holding, did you say 9 foot long?
I think it's shorter because...
Can you pop it on the ground? You're about 6 foot, right? Pop it on the ground.
I am, I'm 6'1".
It's been sharpened
a bit. It's been sharpened, yeah.
I've literally just been told that it was taller, but they have used it and it's been sharpened, so
wonderful.
It's
wonderful.
It keeps getting shorter.
Is it lead? Does it work?
It is. This is a real pencil. Oh, you really? Can see that it actually says HB on it.
Yep.
This guy was really interested. Philip Morrison, he had been at Los Alamos for the nuclear testing.
Mm. Yeah.
And he transported the core of the test device, so the nuclear core, to the test site on the back seat of a Dodge sedan.
So good.
And then he was one of the team, and he was the head of the team that loaded the atomic bombs onto the aircraft before it went to Japan.
Really?
And then he became like a real anti-war person and a real pacifist after that.
Yeah.
Careers are so long and varied, aren't they? As in, if you like, if while
he
was doing
this podcast for 15 years,
I know. But if while he was supervising the team that were loading the nuclear bombs onto the planes, you could have said to him, look, in just over 20 years' time, you're going to be messing around with a giant pencil, that would have reassured him a bit, maybe.
Would it? Or would he think, has the bomb changed us so much that we are a tiny race of humans, no taller than a coin? Yeah, this was part of a lecture, which is one of the great things that this institution has been doing for many, many years. And I was being told beforehand, no matter who was coming in, no matter how famous they were, there was no introduction. They would just walk onto stage. They would not say anything to the crowd. They would not say thank you for coming. They wouldn't do any of the stuff we did, basically, at the beginning of this show, because the information was the star. So when we were waiting prior to this show coming in, we were sat in a room at the back. And that was the room that for many, many years, over 100 years, scientists would be locked in for 10 minutes before their lecture started so that they couldn't run away from doing the lecture. And this was based off a story of a scientist called Wigstone who supposedly got cold feet and he ran away and Michael Faraday had to come at the last second and do his speech on behalf. Now, the records are so amazing here. We know that didn't happen. It never happened. Okay. It was all a myth. They can see that he was ill. He wasn't coming in. Faraday was ready to do it. But they love the idea of it so much that they did then just start locking scientists in the room for 10 minutes prior to the lecture. And they've been doing that ever since.
A lot of them are still there, by the way.
Yeah.
Michael Faraday.
Oh, great. Well,
he was incredibly popular because it was the early days when he was doing it. Yeah, 19 series of lectures. And his most famous one, I think he delivered it several years maybe, was called The Chemical History of a Candle.
Mm.
And it's one of those wonderful things because... it sounds wonderful. It's one of the most successful science books ever. And his basic point was, so much of what we know about science can be encapsulated in a candle, whether that's what the wick is made of, what the air around it does, the sort of flow of air when it's burning, the science of combustion, all of these things come together in the form of a candle. It was written as a book, which I think might be still in print today, nearly 200 years later on. And he was dead against writing it as a book because he said the point about science to communicate it to people is it has to be in a live environment. Lectures are an important way of properly communicating science to people. And then in the 1850s, there was a massive wave of seances which swept across London. And he thought, okay, maybe not enough people know any science. And so he thought, right, okay, I will do it as a book now because it can, you know, get the word out a bit more. And I got the book out of the library today.
Did you?
Yeah.
They still have his notes here, don't they, I think. And the papers are singed. And no one knows really how they got singed, I think, but he used a lot of fire in his experiments. He would get saucers and fill them with brandy and then set fire to them, so we think that's probably what happened. But...
Makes sense.
He was allowed alcohol on stage. We're not allowed alcohol on stage. So once again, it's one rule for Michael Faraday. and one rule for the rest of us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Would we have been allowed alcohol if we could also bring a live flame on stage, I wonder?
Yeah, exactly.
It was in 1825 that the first Christmas lecture happened, and actually that one was quite boring, and it was a series of 22 lectures, and Faraday quickly stepped in and said, you know what, let's go 6 lectures. And let's make it all about demonstrating science. So they all had to have big set pieces in them. So John Tyndall, who took over from Faraday, and by the way, if you're Googling him, he is not the chairman of the National Front in the 1970s. Never lectured here as far as I know. John Tyndall, the physicist, 19th century. In 1867, he put solid carbonic acid in his mouth, and then he breathed out over a candle while this was in his mouth, and the candle turned blue, and then it went out because the carbonic acid made his breath so chilled.
Wow.
And he said at the time that if I'd inhaled with that in my mouth, I would have died.
Oh.
That's the kind of tension people were bringing to the lectures.
Because
it's such a dangerous substance.
Well, how about this one? 1938, so a bit more recent, the Christmas lectures had a boy, maybe about 10 or 11 years old, same as the boys who had the massive pencil. A boy coated his hands in water, and then the scientist delivering the lectures put the boy's hand in a stream of molten lead. And he was fine, but that's an example of the Leidenfrost effect, where, you know,
it's like if you get a really hot pan and you pour water on it, it kind of bounces.
The water evaporates on contact and it makes this tiny, tiny protective layer between you and the molten hot lead. But he was fine.
I think that's amazing because that was in 1938, right? Mm. And that kid's parents has let him come to this lecture when the year before, Julian Huxley, who was their secretary of the London Zoological Society, had brought a live lion into the theatre.
Oh, yes.
He'd brought a lion cub, some snakes, crocodiles, a red kite, and then before even the animals came out, he'd shown a short film of a load of baby seals being clubbed in the Arctic.
Wow.
And we have the video now.
And there are photos of this as well, of the kids stroking the lion as they were doing it. And it turns out, I didn't know this, they used to do that in London Zoo. If you went to London Zoo in the 1930s, you could go to what they call Pets Corner, and just stroke a lion.
Really? That's amazing. Yeah. There used to be an assistant called Bill Coates who would always join, and he would always do the demonstrations. I mean, it might be possible. Charlotte, is it possible that he actually... Oh, Charlotte's still here. Did he design the pencil? He might have designed the pencil. He's that kind of guy.
Possibly.
And one thing that happened was there was a scientist called William Bragg who had him swallow a pressure-sensitive capsule with a radio transmitter on it, and he invited kids to come up on stage to show that if you punched him in the stomach... A local speaker would go, "Rah!"
Nice.
And so kids,
incredible.
Kids came up mid-lecture just pounding him in the stomach while the song was, "Rah, rah!" And
And Dan has swallowed a radio transmitter and is now going to step into the middle. Can I say one thing on the subject of good demonstrations in lectures and how important they are? This isn't a lecture that took place at the RI, but it was by someone called Giles Brindley. He was a British urologist, and he found that injecting certain agents into your, and I can't believe I'm about to use these words in this room, but into your penis, made you have an erection. And this was early on in the 1960s when people didn't really know about how to do that.
So it was sort of pre-Viagra.
They knew how to have erections, sorry. They they didn't know how to conjure them out of thin air, as it were.
And sorry, this is not one of the children's Christmas lectures.
Anyway, he was giving a lecture about how he'd found this substance that could create an erection, which is very useful in urology, and he decided to demonstrate. So he showed a bunch of slides of his own member after he'd taken it, and then he said to this lecture, this audience of academics who were all in their suits, very dry, it happened in Las Vegas at the Urodynamics Society, he said, look, that's not enough, I could have stimulated myself with these pictures, so I'd better show you. I took some of this before I came on stage today.
Wow.
And he stepped out in front of the podium and he pulled his trousers tightly around himself, and you know, he said, anyway, and then he said, look, but that's not enough, that's not enough. And then he pulled down his trousers in front of the entire audience of very dry academics who were wondering what the hell was happening in their lives. And he dropped his pants. And he revealed his member. And then as his final pièce de résistance, he said, "Ah, but we need someone to test the tumescence." The academics' wives in the audience started screaming, and he had to quickly wrap up the lecture prematurely and leave the room.
The lecture was called "What Happens in Vegas Stays in Vegas," wasn't it?
Can I take us away from this, please, and talk about enormous pencils?
Please.
Oh, yeah.
So we said that this was a former world's largest pencil, right? Because the record has since been beaten a few times. And the current largest pencil measures 23.23 meters and weighs 98.43 tons. And it was made by a friend of the podcast, Ashrita Furman, who is basically spends his whole life trying to break as many world records as possible, like hopping backwards with a traffic cone on his head, things like that.
Okay.
And this pencil is the equivalent of 1,900,000 standard size pencils.
Right.
And it's the same length as the world's longest outdoor shot put, the largest wave in the world in 2025, and the world's largest barbecue pit. If you need some perspective.
Yeah, thank you. It's really helpful.
Well, we don't, because I've actually got it back. Yeah.
Can I check something with you? Yeah. Is it a pencil or is it a model of a pencil?
What's the difference?
The difference is pretty clear. If it's got a lead in the middle of it...
It works. It has to work.
It has to work. Yeah, it's a pencil.
Functioning pencil, exactly. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah.
Because sometimes people do make models of pencils and they say this is the world's largest pencil.
Do they?
It's clearly not.
Yeah.
I don't like it. It feels like I'm shaming them now, but... There is a giant pencil. It's in Minneapolis. And actually, it's just a toppled oak tree. I believe it's lead-free. It has got a giant ferrule and a rubber on the end. And every year, there is a ritual sharpening, which is good.
But it's basically a tree that they painted to
it's
the
light. It's basically a painted and shaped tree. I feel bad about it now because it's in Minneapolis and it sounds wonderful. And thousands of people turn up every year to the ritual sharpening, which does sound like my kind of people.
That's
very impressive.
It's just for any pencil fans that might be here tonight or listening at home. A lot in tonight. Okay. A friend of ours, John Hodgman, is a friend of the leading pencil sharpener in the world. His name is David Reese. He wrote a book called How to Sharpen Pencils. And it's a whole book. And he provides a service which started out as you could send him your pencil... And you pay him and he sharpens it for you and sends it back.
No.
But his new service now is he will provide the pencil himself. So if anyone here wants a pencil sharpened...
It feels like the pencil is not the main cost base of his operations, is it? Just getting a new pencil. He'll just send you a sharp pencil.
Well, it's $100 American to...
I beg your pardon.
What?
I think that's worth it.
Do you think
pencil
so?
Pencil sharpeners don't work. Why haven't we nailed the pencil sharpener in this day and age? They always break off a pencil lead.
I think there's a clear territory between pencil sharpeners don't work very well, which I think we can all agree on, and $100 is good value.
Stop the podcast.
Stop the podcast.
Hey everyone, this week's episode of Fish is sponsored by NordVPN.
Yes, if you've been listening to Fish for any number of weeks, you'll know we think that getting a VPN is really important if you care at all about your own online privacy or security, and NordVPN is one of the fastest out there.
Yes, I must say, with the kind of stuff we Google for this show, internet security is the most important thing in my life right now. And it is something that is a pretty amazing feature that you can get. It's got servers across 149 different countries. It means as well, by the way, that if you go overseas and you want to access all the stuff that might be geo-blocked in the country you're now in, but you had back home, you can set your VPN to your home country, which means you have access to everything you were getting there to begin with.
That's right. You can just pretend you're not even on holiday. Go on holiday, sit in your bedroom and watch all those Netflix shows that you'd be missing otherwise.
Yeah. And so if you want to get this and you need to, I think it's very important, you should just go to nordvpn.com/fish and use the offer code FISH.
That's right. And if you do that and get a NordVPN 2-year plan, you will get 4 months extra, completely risk-free, 30-day money-back guarantee. Do it now.
Okay. On with the podcast.
On with the show.
It is time for fact number 2, and that is James.
Okay, my fact this week is that one of the world's oldest cycling road races is getting much harder because people keep stealing the road. This is the Paris-Roubaix cycle race, and it goes over cobblestone roads. And it's very famous because it's very, very difficult to cycle on these cobbles, especially if it's been raining or if they get muddy. And the race's nickname is the Hell of the North, for various reasons we might go into. But this year, the events director, Thierry Gouvenot, has made a plea to the public to leave the rocks in place because people have been taking the cobblestones as souvenirs, and it's hard enough to go over those guys normally. But if there's a big hole where there should be one, then you're going to get big pileups of cyclists.
Yeah, dangerous. Very dangerous.
They say the speed that you go at over those cobbles, you feel literally like you're a jackhammer, like you're just going the whole way through.
And sounds horrendous.
It's a 160-mile-long route, right? Like it's a massive race.
It's one day.
They do get hurt. And Theo de Ruige, a Dutchman, he was asked about it afterwards, and they said, what do you think of the race? He said, it's a bollocks, this race. You're working like an animal, you don't have time to piss, you wet your pants, you're riding in mud like this, you're slipping, it is a pile of shit. And they said, wow, okay. I mean, are you going to do it again? Sure, it's the most beautiful race in the world. That's what the race is to people.
Wow. Yeah.
So it's got quite a good history, and the nickname the Hell of the North doesn't come from how hard the race is. It's named after Terry Hell. No, it's not.
No. Oh, I'm so excited.
Ooh, Andy, first time you've heard an audience get that is your world.
It's basically the cyclists drove through northern France after World War I, and there was so much rubble everywhere and stuff, it was like they were driving through hell. So it is a very, very difficult race, but the Hell of the North was due to the...
Oh, yeah. Interesting.
Because all races were cobbled back in the day, right? No tarmac.
Yeah.
19th century.
And actually, the race is the Paris-Roubaix, but actually doesn't start in Paris anymore. It starts in Compiègne.
It's good that
sure one of those is right.
It's good that you've protected the place's identity like that.
But yeah, they used to start in Paris, but then they got rid of all the cobbled roads in Paris, so there was no point starting there, so they start a bit further out where the cobbles begin.
Nice.
And in fact, this was a problem, right? That the cobbles were disappearing because tarmac was invented and roads kept being tarmacked. And then in the... I think it was the 1960s or 1950s, they said, well, this race is just going to become really boring because it's going to be flat and easy. And there's a guy called Jean Stablinski, who was a former cyclist, and he was also a former miner, and he knew of these really cobbled paths. He won a bicycle in an accordion competition.
Okay.
Okay.
Whoa, whoa, whoa.
As you do.
As you do.
Is this being held down the mine? Because that is the most impractical thing you can give someone down a mine.
The acoustics are very good there, though.
No, a bicycle, not an accordion.
Oh! I thought you meant, is that how they lowered him down? They just held one end of the accordion each. Okay.
Cycle your way up. I don't think it was down the mine, but no, he won this bicycle in an accordion competition, so he started cycling. His mum was so pissed off he started cycling that she destroyed his first bike. Anyway, he basically founded this race in its modern iteration because he became a cyclist and then added cobbles to all of these roads, or found lots of routes that were very, very cobbly.
So the prize in the race is a cobblestone, which is interesting, but it's not one of the... Obviously, they don't take it from a bit of the route. These are cobbles which have been blown up during the First and Second World Wars, right? Lots of roads were bombarded and lots of them were blown up, and the cobbles were blown all over the place. And they then go into the soil, and every year farmers plow up cobblestones that used to be on the roads. So it's one of these dug up cobblestones that becomes the prize.
Wow.
Yeah. It's very cool. But
they're really big old things, aren't they?
Yeah, because you get little round cobblestones lots of places here, but these are big flat. They're like bricks, but they are much less easy.
So you get a cobblestone, and you also get a brass plaque of your name, which goes onto the shower block, which is at the very end. There's a big old shower that all the cyclists are supposed to go to.
Yeah.
In actual fact, it's a horrible old shower. And no one really goes in there.
Oh, really?
But it's like a really famous part of the race. So you get three lots of people who use it. Basically, the youngest people who are there for the first ever year. And they're like, oh, wow, like, I really need to try the showers because they're so famous. And then you get the really old ones who just want to embrace the history of the race. And then you get a third group who use these showers. Can you guess who they are?
People who've been injured and need to wash sort of mud.
Well, they could still use normal showers.
Yep. Okay.
Oh. Yeah.
Okay.
The bicycles.
The bicycles themselves?
Yeah.
On their own?
Yeah.
No.
Some of the race crew, the stuff?
No, it's not. It's the ones who are sponsored by shampoo companies.
Ah.
And so at the end of the race, those ones always come in, do a little bit of a rub down with the shampoo, and then go straight off to their nice warm showers afterwards.
You've just been through absolute hell for 116 miles, and then you have to film a shampoo advert. That's like a bad dream.
How many guesses do you think we would have had to have gone through before we'd got to that? I
wonder. Here's a very cool bit of the road crew who work on it. So there's a team of people who are employed to maintain the cobbles, yeah, not to make them nice and smooth. It's not possible, but just to make sure they're, you know, they're there and kind of serviceable. But there is a team of extra employees who are hired. Can anybody guess what their job is?
Well, in the Tour de France, they have people who are employed because people draw penises on the ground.
Yes.
And they employ people to turn them into beautiful butterflies.
Yes.
Is it that?
It's not that. These people have to, these crew have to eat something as part of their job. What's and I it? Corrected people to crew there. Good
okay,
riddle.
Okay, so
good
they riddle. Might be animals.
They might be animals. Good riddle, Andy. Oh,
so
cool.
They have to... I know, because they're yeah. near farms, so there's near often farms. Like horse poo and stuff on there.
Yeah.
So they employ a load of dung beetles to push away the poles of dung just before the bikes get there.
He's got it.
Wow.
It's a team of goats.
Eating grass.
Eating the veg in between the cobbles.
Okay, right.
Yeah. And the human are called the Fossat du Pavé, convicts of the cobbles. How cool is that?
Oh, that's like a society.
But there's a human team of maintenance people too.
They're not eating the...
They're not eating the stuff. Well, I think they're banned from it, but yeah.
The method ones are, yeah. So, that's like a crew that you join. It's a society, and that's not even when the race is happening. That's year-round. They just make sure they love the cobble. So they're probably looking out for the cobble stealers that we're talking about. This is a very old race. 1896. Like the bicycle proper was only invented in the 1860s. So we're talking like 30, 40 years after the invention of the actual modern bicycle that they started doing this insane race. And even the person who did the first mapping of the route didn't want the race to happen. So basically there were two creators. There was Perez and there was Vienne. And they were like, we're going to end it in Belgium or France. We don't know which way, but we can't be there at both ends. We need someone to start or end it. They decided Paris would start it. And they needed to get the local newspaper on their team. And so the Paris newspaper sent a man called Paul Rousseau to actually ride what might be a route. And he did it, and he got to the end, and he was going to write immediately and say, no human should do this. This is mad. This is insane. But then these two guys, Perez and Vienne, took him out to dinner, got him drunk, and then he was like, yeah, it'll be fine. It'll be cool. And that's why we have it.
That's so funny.
Yeah. Right.
And then, like, for 125 years, women were not allowed to do it until 2021.
It's quite recent, isn't it?
Oh, it's so long ago now, 2021. And the winner was Lizzie Danan, who's British, I think. And the sad thing about that was, and this, in fairness, this happens in a lot of cycle races, which is you don't watch the first hour or so because it's quite boring. They're just going really slowly. And then someone attacks and then it gets interesting. But she attacked at the very first sector. And so by the time the camera started, she was already so far ahead that no one was ever going to catch her.
Oh,
and so the entire like broadcast was just her being miles in front of everyone else and just winning.
But oh, sorry, I thought you meant the people who were filming couldn't catch her. Like, surely they've invented cars for this race. Yeah, I know they hadn't invented women yet.
She's the only British cyclist to win this race. So it's...
Was she winning the mixed?
No. There was the women's... Race. Yeah, so 2021 was the first women's race. She won that. Bradley Wiggins has done it quite a few times. I think he came 9th is the closest that he ever got. Yeah.
So not we very good.
Sorry?
Not very good, is it?
Not coming home. No.
Not coming home.
Do you know what? Do you know he's in a team? He's in Sky Team. That's what he wrote
was,
for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was in Sky Team. Do you know what the first professional team he was in when he started racing?
Well,
because they're in teams, Andy. Like you're in like a you get like
US all right. Postal?
Okay. No.
It was the Linda McCartney Racing Team.
Yes.
Which focused largely on racers who were vegetarians as well as the crew. Yeah.
Wow. Well, I mean, talking about women's cycling, and the reason I asked if it was a mixed race is that actually cycling is one of the things that women and men could be on a par at in future. And in fact, there's this thing called the RAM, which is the Race Across America. And
it is R-A-A-M, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It is. Yeah.
Race Across America.
It's meant to be the most extreme cycling race in the world. It's absolutely insane. People who do it have these crazy hallucinations. They go mad. They start dribbling and shrieking and, you know, thinking they're being murdered and stuff. But the... It's 3,000 miles, so it's across America. You're not allowed to take longer than 12 days. And the winners of the Ram in 2021 and 2023 were both women, and that's mixed gender Ram. So 2021, it was actually, and I'm always doing this, having just turned 40, looking up things I could still achieve. And the winner in 2021 was a woman called Leah Goldstein, who was 52.
Mm.
Yeah, well, she doesn't listen, it's fine, but...
Was she American?
I think so, yeah. I think she was Israeli because she used to be a bantamweight kickboxing champion in Israel, which, to be fair, I haven't achieved before the age of 40, and she had.
Right.
And she was also the 1998 duathlon champion. But aside from that, I could do it.
Yeah.
There was the very first Ram had only four racers in it, and one of them was a guy called Michael Shermer. And I don't think he's won the Ram, but he did invent a new medical problem off the back of something he experienced.
You know how
you sort of hope that one day something horrible is going to be named after you in a medical sense?
Is it a cycling injury?
Yeah, it's called Shermer's neck.
Oh!
Okay, that's not the part of the body I thought you were going to go.
Yeah. So Shermer's neck is a thing when you've been riding so long and your body has really, really gone to its edge that suddenly your neck just gives up and your head just drops.
Oh my God.
And you can't do anything and it's just gone. The muscles are entirely gone. And so Shermer had to hold his head up for the rest of the race. Yeah, with one hand on the handlebars. And he's not the only person to have this. So multiple people have had Shermer's neck, and you can even buy devices because they don't give up once their neck gives up.
Cyclists.
They pull over and they put on a device that just pulls their head up. And they just ride the rest of this insane thing that they're doing.
At least at the end of the race, it's quite easy to put the medal over him.
Okay, it is time for fact number three, and that is my fact. My fact this week is that 150 years before there was a social network called X, run by a man called Musk, there was a social network called X, run by a man called Busk. Insane.
It's incredible. Stunning. Yeah.
So Elon Musk named X, and Ellen Busk named the other X from 150 years ago. And basically, I was doing research about Albemarle Street, the street that we're on, which this is an amazing road, by the way. There's so many incredible things that have happened here. There was a publisher's just next door where Byron was published by them. And when he died, all of his memoirs and papers were burnt.
Yeah.
That happened just next door over there.
Yeah.
There was the Albemarle Club where Oscar Wilde was accused of being a sodomite. And that happened literally on the road that we're on. That ruined his life, sent him to jail. But so while I was reading that, I discovered that on the 3rd of November, 1864, at St. George's Hotel on this road, a social network was set up called the X Club. And it was run by 9 great scientists, one of whom was George Busk. This was one of the very first scientific groups, and they called it a social network at the time. And the idea was they could see that science was being excluded from so many places where it was needed in terms of political power in schools and so on. And they thought, let's get together and start discussing how we can inject science into these places. So literally around the corner, they changed the landscape of how this country operated because they were all very influential people. George Busk and his wife Ellen were very much a part of this. Thomas Huxley was the original. John Lubbock, a lot of people who would have lectured in this very room. And Ellen called it the X Club because she said, you need a name where you can just change and adapt to what the club is. You don't want to get stuck right into one thing.
It means you can talk about anything because X can be anything.
Right.
Yeah.
Two quick thoughts on the name?
Yep.
Mm.
Firstly, should have called themselves the X-Men, because they were all men. The second point, there were 9 of them.
Yeah.
And their symbol is X, which is, of course, Latin for 9.
Yeah.
Mm. I'm just seeing two big missed opportunities here.
Yeah. You want them to build the one X club, the IX club.
The IX men. I don't think.
Or you invite one more person in. And then you could, there's 10 of you. Right?
Well, yeah. They kept on trying to invite people in, didn't they? They kept on.
We need just one more. Really need...
We don't like anyone else. No, there was this constant chat, as you can imagine. They were saying, look, should we get Barry in, or, you know, should we get, you know, Dorothy? And eventually, they apparently, various attempts to add more members became so wearisome, this is according to Huxley, that Huxley made this new rule. He said that no idea of someone joining the club shall be entertained unless the name of the new member contains all the consonants absent from the old ones.
Okay.
So I had a look. The only consonants that are remaining once you go through all the names are Q, V, and Z. And the only famous person I could find who was alive at the time was a guy called Vasquez, V-A-Z-Q-U-E-Z, who was a Galician musician who invented a thing called the technophone, which looks a bit like a piano, but when it plays, when you play notes, it replicates the human voice.
Can you imagine if he turned up and gone, I'm here, guys? Then I'd have to go, what's your first name? That is amazing. One thing they did do, speaking of names, is they gave each other nicknames. And all the nicknames had to begin with X. So there was the Exquisite Lubbock, the Excellent Spottiswood, the Experienced Hooker, the Eccentric Tyndall, the Exemplary Busk. And so they gave themselves these X nicknames.
Yeah, nice. They did have alternative names as well. So Huxley's original idea was calling it the Blastodermic Club. And blastodermic is a layer of cells inside the ovum of birds. It acts as the center of development for the entire bird. So that's what they thought they were. They were on the inside.
I think we'll just go with X, actually. Thanks. Thank you. Yeah, we are writing down that suggestion.
Hands up for blastodermic. No.
The Thorough Club.
Okay.
I quite like that.
Yeah.
No, it sounds quite dull, doesn't it? There seemed to be contradictory views on what it was for. So what Huxley said was, it had nothing to do with science, this club. It was basically because we were all great mates, but we were all getting quite busy and successful, and we weren't hanging out very much. And so we literally said, let's make a date every month to hang out. And he really denied that there was any other purpose. And in fact, he said that if others had been present at the meetings, they would have been incredibly disappointed at the sadly frivolous tone of our ordinary conversations.
Interesting. Really? Well, they were accused of only working to each other's mutual advantage. You know, they were accused of being a bit of a self-promotion society. They would lobby for each other, you know, for their own members to get a particular eminent position in the world of science, that kind of thing. So they were advancing the cause of science, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't totally without self-interest, I guess.
Yeah, the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography, which is normally very even-handed, says the motives were never entirely pure, the reasons not entirely consistent, and the means not entirely admirable. Advancing the cause of science and advancing themselves were often conflated.
Wow!
But you could say the same about us.
Well, you know what? The reason I don't like them is because they had some sworn enemies.
Ooh.
And their sworn enemies were the North British scientists.
Oh, dear.
But actually, they were based in Scotland, so a bit further north Britain than where I'm from.
Yeah.
But Lord Kelvin was one of them, and James Clerk Maxwell, so quite big, famous guys. And the difference really between them was the North British ones believed in miracles.
Oh.
You sexy thing. Yeah, I know. I know that look in your eye, Andy. But yeah, they thought that you could like get science and you could also get miracles, and there was sort of an in-between, that there was an invisible realm that was affecting our realm. And the X Club were more like, no, science is science and religion shouldn't get involved and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
Yeah, you're crazy, Scott.
Wow.
They
had a lot of little phrases and words that we use in science today came from these nine people in a room. Huxley came up with the term agnostic, I guess the concept of agnostic to go with it as well. Survival of the fittest, that was Herbert Spencer. I think Herbert Spencer also invented what was like the original paperclip as well. So, you know, he had a prototype thing that held papers together, and he argued that, come on, I was basically there.
Bet no one's done this before.
Yeah.
Was it Huxley who invented agnostic, it was, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Because, and he did it to overcome social awkwardness because he was at gatherings of the Metaphysical Society and it was all either atheists or religious people who had their denomination. And he said he felt like a historical fox when, after leaving the trap in which his tail remained, he presented himself to his normally elongated companions, which I think the tail is the label that everyone else had, and he's got no tail.
What?
Yeah, I know. Look, I'm not saying he had a way with words. I'm not saying I necessarily delivered it. He was a scientist. But, he, you know, he said it, he felt like he didn't have a label. He felt like he was a fox without a tail. And so he called himself agnostic. Because the Gnostics were people who claimed to know everything, and he was saying, I don't know anything.
Oh, really?
And so, yeah, and then he said, I pranced back into the next meeting of the society like a fox, you know.
Oh, stop with the fox tail. Thing, though. It's not it's not working.
It's got an X in it.
That's it has got an X in it, yeah.
So they would, like, they would all meet together, and a lot of it was down to Lubbock's wife, Lady Lubbock, and she would organise all of the get-togethers. And then when she died in 1879, basically went into decline. So Lady Lubbock, she was the daughter of the guy who founded the Pitt Rivers Museum in Oxford. So she was already part of that world. But yeah, she married this Lubbock guy. She died. Then they kind of stopped going to the meetings and they all got a bit old and they started to get sick. And so they couldn't meet on cold nights anymore. And basically they just all became very grumpy old men.
It's classic men and friendships.
It really
if your
is.
Wife is not making you go and be friends, you just stay at home and then die.
I mean, yeah.
It's not good, you know.
I mean, that's life, isn't
it? It's what
it?
We like, yeah. 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 I did read it declined until the very last meeting was in 1889. It was just two of them left. And they were just there for the evening and they sort of said, well, this hasn't really worked, has it?
You know. Who oh, was
no,
it?
Sorry, maybe that was 1893. 1889 was when they had their final row, when Huxley ridiculed in the Times Spencer's a priori reasoning against land socialism. Devastating.
Wow.
Yeah.
There's a slightly interesting moment which is connected to the main fact, which is, I think it was 1892, Nikola Tesla came to do a speech in the very room that we're in right now. And it's highly likely that one of the members of X were in the room listening to that speech as well. So at one point, Tesla and X were in the same room. There was one guy as well called John Tyndall who used to do lectures in here as well, and he was one of the members of X. And there's a great lecture that happened here. It's a real seminal one. It happened on the 1st of February, 1878, and it was the first time that the telephone was publicly shown to members of the public, right? So I think scientists had seen it, it had been displayed in academic circles, but so they showed it here for the very first time. And because they had basically 10 minutes of spare time at the end, they went, oh, let's show you another new invention. It's called the phonograph. They made a recording in the room live, and then they played it back to the room. So John Tyndall did a recording of a Tennyson poem, and Tennyson was in the audience listening to it being done. And he was so blown away by it that he then spent a large part of the rest of his career recording onto the vinyl because he just thought this is the most magical thing that we have. I say vinyl, the early days of, But you imagine the phone and the vinyl player.
Why didn't they play the vinyl down the phone?
Yeah, like a voicemail. Sorry, Tennyson's not in right now.
Stop the podcast.
Stop the podcast.
Hey, everyone. This week's episode of Fish is sponsored by Saily.
Yes, Saily is an eSIM service app. It basically means if you've gone on holiday with your friends or family, you get to the airport, you've got so much other faffing to do, you do not have to go and buy a physical SIM from some dodgy SIM dealer because it's all on your phone and ready for you.
And it is so worth it. I cannot tell you the importance of Saily on your phone for when you're going overseas. The last thing you want to do is head back home and find yourself landed with a bill that basically costs more than the trip itself because you were Googling stuff along the way, making a few phone calls. Saily stops all of that, and it is available in over 200 destinations.
Yes, it is. is it also has various other perks, like it's got a built-in ad blocker and it has 24/7 support. And all you need to do is download the app. It's compatible with iOS or Android. You buy a plan for whatever country you're in and off you go. Off you pop. Get online.
Get online. Do it now. And because you're a Fish listener, we've got an exclusive discount for you. So you will get 15% off on your Saily eSIM data plan if you download the Saily app and use the code FISH at checkout.
That is right. Save on all of those data roaming international bills. Get Saily right now. On with the show.
On with the podcast.
Okay, it is time for our final fact of the show, and that is Andy.
My fact is, in Cambodia, there is a special hotline for fishermen to ring if they accidentally catch a fish that is too big.
How do you accidentally catch a fish?
Yeah, well, you get a bite, you tug away for a bit, and then you haul it in, and then...
It's much bigger than you thought it was.
It's much bigger than you thought it was, okay. Yeah, basically. So,
and is this a very special type of fish, or is it just any big fish?
It is the Mekong giant catfish. Ooh. So cool. This is one of the most amazing fish in the world. It's just about the largest freshwater fish in the world. Before you shout out, I know one or two stingrays have been bigger, I know, but... that's why I said among the largest freshwater fish in the world. They get up to 3 meters long. They weigh up to 300 kilos...
Wow. So bigger than the pencil.
Yeah.
Wow. The world record is pretty much in the ballpark that you said. So 2.7 meters and weighing 293 kilograms. And that means you could make about 10,000 fish fingers out of it.
And that would be a good and noble way for that fish to die.
I mean, once it's dead.
Like, Captain Birdseye's rubbing his hands up on deck. So basically, the problem is the Mekong giant catfish, they're wonderful fish, and as they get older and bigger, they can produce more offspring. So the really big old ones can produce, I think, 20 times as many offspring as even a 50-kilo fish. 50 kilos is not tiny, but they get so much bigger. Mm. But they, you know, millions of people rely on the Mekong River. There's lots and lots of fishing. There's lots of pollution. There are dams in the way. There's overfishing, all sorts of things. So the fish are getting a lot smaller, you know, because the bigger, older ones have been caught. And they're not getting a chance to grow to their full size. So there is this wonderful new team. They have launched the Mekong Fish app, and the fishermen have downloaded the app, basically. And there's a rapid response team. And if you accidentally find yourself pulling a 200-kilo catfish into your boat, you just get on the blower. They come down, they tag it, they re-release it. And I think in 9 months, 92 megafish, which have been accidentally caught, have been returned to the water. And they do a little ritual. They'll sprinkle it with flowers, which must absolutely blow its mind. Like, what the hell is this? and then they chuck it back in.
Maybe that's why they're getting caught so much these days. Oh, you ought to check out this flower thing, man. This is... it's insane. No, they put you back in. It's nuts. They don't even... this lady comes, she tags you, you're back in. That's.
So it's a very clever thing to do. Yeah.
It's important because these fish, they're getting smaller as well, aren't they?
Yeah.
You'd be hard pressed to find one that's even half the size of that one that we mentioned earlier. And the reason is because in the past, people were catching the biggest ones because they're the biggest, that's the easiest to find. And then over generations, they just get smaller and smaller because the smaller ones survive.
Yeah.
And it's quite a good thing, you know, that I think generally speaking, because the Mekong is in quite a lot of countries, but most of these countries now are all trying to do something to help these catfish.
Yes, I think it's half a dozen countries the Mekong goes through, and it floods massively, and it's full of smaller fish to eat, which is all the reason it can get so big. There was one caught in the 1980s. I love this. It took 100 men 2 hours to land.
Nice.
Right.
That's crazy.
100 men? What are the 99 men doing who aren't holding the rod?
They're just doing, like, encouraging.
They're in the pub going, pull! No, my wife's at home. She said I had to come.
Have you guys ever seen fighting chairs? I think anyone who's sort of like into fishing is familiar with fighting chairs, but they're so cool. So if you've got any respectable fishing boat that you're going out in to catch vaguely big fish, a tuna or a marlin, then fishermen strap themselves into a fighting chair. The fighting chair is bolted onto the boat through the boat. You stick your feet into these foot holders so you've got something to push your heels against. And it's so that when you catch a big fish, you fight it. And the fights can last so long. So I found one fish fight It was in 1990. It was a Marlin, and it was caught by a guy called Schumacher. And he was in the chair for how long, do you think, altogether?
This one was 2 hours, I'll say 2 hours, 10 minutes.
Nice, thank you, appreciate that.
Dan, do you want to come in and absolutely trounce this?
16 years.
Thanks a lot, Dan. 23 hours.
Wow. Oh.
23 hours in the chair. At 22 hours, he said, I'm really sorry, I'm desperate for the loo. And he took a bathroom break, and then he came back.
At 22 hours?
22 hours he lasted.
That's more impressive.
And what, does the tuna just go, okay, well, while you're going to the toilet, fair's fair, tuna's, I just won't pull for a bit.
The tuna's been bursting for a piss for ages.
They respect the rules. Yeah. His mate took the line for a while.
Okay. Right.
Could his mate not have helped in the first 22 hours?
You got a lot of beers to get through in those cool boxes. Anyway, the fish won. Got away in the end.
Good.
Yeah, nice.
Oh,
wicked. There's a lot of species of catfish. There's like thousands. And they're all over the world. I've got a quiz question for you, though.
Mm-hmm. Oh, great.
Okay. So in Florida, there is fish farms where they don't farm catfish, but the farmers have had to erect fences around their ponds to protect them. Why?
Stop fish from outside getting in and eating their fish.
Jumping in.
Yeah.
Again. Yeah.
To stop flying fish getting in and eating their fish.
Yeah. But
QED.
But no as well.
Okay.
Is he right or not?
No. What do you mean flying fish? Fish that, like, what, have chartered an airline?
No. Fish will jump over the net.
Imagine there's a landmass in between another body of water.
Oh, then
okay,
I don't know.
Close, right? Because otherwise you wouldn't have sort of...
Yeah.
Is
it like... Is it people throwing fish into it from...
It's good.
No.
Is it, right, there's a forest fire and a helicopter picks up loads of water from the ocean, drops it prematurely, and all the fish from its load fall into the pond.
I like it.
And how's the fence that is standing vertically?
It's a really high fence.
Yeah, right. Sorry.
There are some fish that can walk.
Catfish can walk. It is insane. Catfish can walk like 1.2 miles. They can...
Crazy.
They can stay out of water for about 18 hours just walking along, and they kept going in these ponds, and so they were like, stay out of my pond, and they had to build fences. Imagine building a fence to stop fish from walking into your pond.
That's incredible.
Unbelievable.
But they can do it. It's an extraordinary thing, and there's even a new word that's been invented called reffling, which describes the method by which catfish walk along. They use their mouth, they use their tail, they use their body.
Reffling.
They reffle along, yeah. And it's a word, it's now a word.
Sounds like crawling. I don't mean to denigrate the catfish, well done them, but yeah, that doesn't sound like walking. I've got a child who's on the cusp of walking, but who mostly crawls, and I don't confuse the two. I don't keep saying, oh my God, he's walking. And people go, what? He's on his hands and knees.
But you wouldn't expect a walking catfish to just get up on two legs and saunter along.
Yeah. Wearing a tux, yeah. On fish conservation, the inventors of Roomba, the Hoover, have got involved in fish conservation. They've invented a Hoover to hoover up fish.
Have they?
Yeah, because if you do one thing
Sounds bad.
It does, but what they're doing is they're hoovering up a fish that hoovers up other fish. So the lionfish is invasive in the Atlantic. It's from the Pacific. It got over there, probably that bloody Panama Canal. And... it's got no native predators.
Enemy of the podcast.
Enemy of the
Panama Canal. Yeah.
Who thought that was a good idea? All the lionfish came over, and they can reduce the population of a reef, of the fish on a reef, by 80% very, very quickly. Mm. They can eat 20 fish an hour. So that's within 5 weeks, they can reduce the population by 80%. So the Roomba guys have got a remote-controlled Hoover that they pop into the water, and it's controlled with like a game controller, PlayStation controller or whatever, from a ship, from a boat. And it's got two arms, this little robot thing that stun the fish, and then it sucks it into a tube, and then it plops it into a tank, like your Hoover bag. And then it gets sold to restaurants, and it stops eating thought I'd skate over that bit quite
quickly. No. Honestly, that was a happier ending than I thought would happen for the fish.
Did you? The big salt restaurant? It's how he wanted to
I thought
to
it
go.
Was just a big mincing machine in the Hoover bag or something.
I'll be honest, in the restaurant, there's probably some kind of big mixing machine going on as well.
That's true.
What a weird business pivot for Roomba. Can you imagine? They're like, we've become a household name. They're all sitting, all the shareholders in the room. What's next, boss?
Can we do it anywhere but carpets? Have you tried?
Wow. So is it happening?
It is happening at quite a small scale. It was also the idea of a guy called Colin Angle.
Oh.
Of angling.
And fish have scales of a small scale. And so you're welcome.
Thank you, Dan. For next time, don't need that, but thank you.
Okay, but it might be rolled out in a bigger way.
Or? Yeah, it's one of these ideas that has not been rolled. It's not saving all the fish life, but it's saving.
If you have to have a person controlling it every single one,
I think you have to send gamers out, take them out of their attics, put them on ships.
Probably you can get AI to do it now and just get AI on that, and like just ChatGPT will see a picture of it and go, "That's a picture of Nick Clegg." No, I think it's a lyrefish. Oh, yes, yeah, sorry, it's a lyrefish.
Good point.
Meanwhile, Nick Clegg's being attacked by, 1,000?
Roombas. This is a movie that has to get made.
Then you're in the restaurant. I think I'll have...
It can't be. It looks... No.
Can I have that one that looks like Nick Clegg?
Okay, that is it. That is all of our facts. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to get in contact with any of us about the things we've said on this podcast, we're all online. You can find us, and we're going to be back again next week with another live episode from the Royal Institution. Thank you, everyone, for being here. We really appreciate it, and we will see you again. Goodbye.